Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. On the show, we will hear from an ISU professor and a student about an exhibit and presentation at Ames Library. It's called Black Lives Matter, Fashion, Liberation, and Freedom. We will also talk with Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, who is on Ames City Council. The topics will be municipal internet and parking in Ames, so stay tuned for that. It looks like the wintry weather that started in November rolled right on into December, bringing us a wet, sleety, snowy weekend. Though it does not look like we'll have more snow this week, it will be cold, barely getting above freezing all week. Highs today and Tuesday will be in the high 20s, and we will have a mix of sun and clouds. Then the rest of the week, right into the weekend, will be mostly sunny. It might just make it to 32 degrees on Wednesday, but the rest of the week's high temperatures will only be in the 20s and dip into the teens every night. I noticed a bit of weather information that I had not seen before. Hours of sunlight each day. So the good news for this week is that on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we will have 8 hours of sun each day. I want to remind our listeners that it is still our fall membership drive, so we are asking you to consider all that Local Talk and KHOI provides to you and to the community. The people stories, the animal stories, the funny and the sad, the news and the music. If you value all of that or any of that, now is the time to step up and become a member. Basic membership is $55, and the easiest way to donate is to go to the website, khoifm.org, and click the donate button on the left side. It is quick and safe and secure, and once you do that, we want to say welcome to the KHOI family. Now, let's go ahead and start today's show with news from Dennis Hart.
Thanks very much, Gail. It's good to be here on this first Monday in December. We begin with news from the world of politics. Iowa officials were expressing their condolences this past weekend over the passing of former President George H.W. Bush. Senator Chuck Grassley said that Mr. Bush had led, in Grassley's words, an incredible life, and that he honorably served the nation. Senator Joni Ernst praised Mr. Bush's commitment to, in her words, sharing the American value of freedom and democracy. Governor Kim Reynolds said, in her words, that America has lost a great leader, a man whose legacy is one of service, statesmanship, and values. She ordered flags to be lowered for 30 days to honor Mr. Bush. There was also word last week that climate change could threaten Iowa's farm economy. A newly released National Climate Assessment, a federal study done once every 4 years, says that crop yields could be reduced by ongoing changes in seasonal rainfall and the severity of heat waves, that there could be a potential 25% drop in corn yields by the middle of the century, and that urban areas could see more damaging floods, especially in springtime. Intense heat waves could prevent corn and soybeans from pollinating, and heavy spring rains followed by summer droughts could tighten an already shortened planting window. Last week also brought word that nearly $31 million in bailout payments were on the way to Iowa farmers who have been harmed by ongoing U.S. trade disputes. About 4,300 payments have been made to farmers. The average payment has been about $7,200. Those payments are designed to help U.S. pork, soybean, corn, and other farmers who have seen prices tumble due to the Trump administration's trade fights with China, Canada, Mexico, and other countries. In other news, officials from Drake University said last week that an 18-year-old Drake student is responsible for 4 of the 5 racist notes found in residence halls and faces criminal charges. The female student admitted writing one of the notes, and she also had reported receiving at least one of the notes. The student faces harassment charges. Also last week, the man accused of fatally stabbing Iowa State student Celia Barkane Arosemena got a new lawyer. 22-year-old Colin Richards had filed a motion requesting a new lawyer because of a communication issue. A district court judge told Richards she would appoint a lawyer from the state public defender's Marshalltown office to represent Richards. His previous lawyer was public defender Paul Rounds. Richards' trial is set to begin next April. The Des Moines Register reported last week that over the past 5 years, several serious allegations of assault and sexual abuse have been reported at the Clarinda Academy, a for-profit foster care facility in southwest Iowa. Colin Richards went to that academy 5 years ago. It's home to delinquent youth from 13 to 18 years old, and it has housed hundreds of children with behavioral and mental health issues. Also last week, an Iowa State University football player pleaded guilty to a harassment charge for pointing a BB gun's laser light at others on campus last August. 18-year-old Dallas Taylor Cortez was given a deferred judgment and 1 year probation. He was suspended from the team following the incident and was suspended again last month for a violation of team rules. Also last week, a Roman Catholic diocese defended its decision to continue employing a priest who told police he was trying to rape a woman when he was arrested naked in an Iowa mall 5 years ago. The Diocese of Sioux City issued a statement for the first time, acknowledging the incident involving the Reverend Jeremy Wind. The diocese called it a mental health episode from which Wind recovered with the help of medication and treatment. Last week also brought word that an Iowa man accused of posting nude pictures of his ex-girlfriend on Craigslist has been sentenced in South Dakota to nearly 6 years in federal prison. 32-year-old David Vincent Jr. of Council Bluffs had pleaded guilty to cyberstalking and failing to pay child support. Also last week, word that 58 Iowa inmates are suing state officials in federal court, seeking $25,000 each in damages. They claim they have been denied a constitutional right to pornography in the state's prison system. The lawsuit seeks to overturn a new state law that has shut down designated pornography reading rooms in Iowa's prisons. That law also prohibits inmates from having nude photos in their cells. Also last week, a former Waukee student whose parents said she was bullied for 4 years was awarded a $150,000 settlement from the school district. The parents of 11-year-old Berkeley Moshka had filed a federal lawsuit against the Waukee Community School District, claiming administrators failed to protect her from ongoing bullying and then assaulted her when she refused to go to her classroom. Last week also brought news that Iowa's auditor issued a report that the state's Medicaid leaders are now correctly calculating how much the state is saving by having private companies manage the $5 billion Medicaid program. The auditor's office estimates that the fiscal year 2018 savings will be $126 million. This after earlier savings estimates range from $47 million to $234 million. Also last week, a Northern Iowa hospital notified about 1,900 patients that there may have been inappropriate access to their medical records. Mercy Medical Center North Iowa in Mason City said the records were accessed by an employee between July 2017 and this past July, but officials had not been able to determine whether the records were viewed for job-related purposes. The employee would not have been able to access financial information such as Social Security numbers. The employee resigned from the job before the hospital learned about the potentially problematic access. This past weekend, the long-awaited MedFarm Iowa opened in Windsor Heights. It's the Des Moines metro area's first medical marijuana dispensary. More than a dozen people lined up outside the dispensary an hour before it was set to open on Saturday morning. Meanwhile, the presidents of Iowa's three state universities asked Governor Kim Reynolds to support state general funding totaling nearly $500 million for higher education for the upcoming state budget year. That request is a boost of nearly 4% over the current funding of $481 million. The funding would provide $221 million for the University of Iowa, $177 million for Iowa State University, and nearly $100 million for the University of Northern Iowa. Also last week, student workers at Grinnell College voted to expand unionization of student workers, but the move could be short-lived because school officials oppose it and plan to appeal the validity of the election to a national labor board. If the board rules for the school, it could end all student union drives at the nation's private universities and colleges. There was also word last week that Iowa school students are less likely to come into contact with a school librarian now than a decade ago. The number of librarians working in Iowa has declined 20% in the past 10 years. Over the past two decades, the number of Iowa school librarians has dropped 40%. There was word last week that a Clive woman had been arrested and accused of pouring gasoline on a man and setting him on fire. 24-year-old Katie Lee Cuesta was charged with willful injury. Her lawyer said the accusations against her are exaggerated. The man went to the hospital with third-degree burns. In Sioux City last week, the city council banned people from carrying some types of toy firearms. The ordinance bans pellet and BB guns. It does not ban Nerf or squirt guns or guns that shoot suction cup darts. The Sioux City police chief said officers have had multiple encounters with replica weapons and faced the question of whether to use deadly force. Last week also brought word that a man was sent to the hospital after his car left the roadway and drove into a pond in Urbandale. The man, who was the only person in the car, was able to breathe in a pocket of air near the passenger seat. Firefighters tied to ropes were able to open the passenger door and get the man out. Also last week, word that a 13-year-old girl led officers on a vehicle chase that hit speeds of 100 miles an hour in eastern Iowa. She and five other young people were taken into custody after the minivan was stopped on the west side of Davenport. Meanwhile, Alliant Energy made news last week when it asked customers in six Marshall County communities to temporarily reduce their natural gas usage while emergency repairs were made to a gas transmission line. The request was made on Tuesday, asking customers to conserve gas through Thursday morning by turning down their thermostats a few degrees or by limiting other uses. There were at least a couple of heartwarming stories that made the rounds last week. One is about the Canadian woman who is thankful to be alive after she spent more than 3 days stranded in her car when it got stuck in the mud on a rural Iowa road. 72-year-old Terry Harnish of Hubbards, Nova Scotia, was visiting friends on Thanksgiving when she took a wrong turn onto a dirt road outside Fairfield and her vehicle got stuck in the mud. She spent the next few days turning the car off and on for heat and snacking on the two things she had with her, a bottle of kombucha and marzipan cake. She was rescued when her car was discovered by a group of snowmobilers. The other heartwarmer involves a beloved Hamilton County truck stop that closed last month. Turns out that the Boondocks USA truck stop on Interstate 35 near Williams was purchased at an auction and it will reopen. The truck stop's former owners closed it in October after 45 years as a legendary traveler's rest and meeting spot. The new owners, Anyway Logistics out of Fresno, California, bought the property for $500,000. And to wrap things up, let's talk about college football around Iowa this past week. First, Iowa State University's coach Matt Campbell was named the Big 12 Coach of the Year for the second season in a row, sharing the honor with Oklahoma's Lincoln Riley. Then the Cyclones went out and defeated Drake University 27-24 at Jack Trice Stadium. It was the last game of the regular season, but the Cyclones were chosen to play in the Alamo Bowl on December 28th against Washington State of the Pac-12 Conference. And the University of Northern Iowa season ended on a losing note. UNI lost to the University of California at Davis 23-16 in the second round of the Football Championship Subdivision playoffs. And that is your summary of a busy week of news indeed from around the state of Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday with a look at what makes news in the pages of the Ames Tribune. In the meantime, I hope you have a great week.
That was John Coltrane playing My Favorite Things. We've been joined now by Kelly Reddy Best, an assistant professor in the Department of Apparel, Events, and Hospitality Management, or AWESOME, as they like to be called at ISU. thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And you've brought two students with you, Brandon Spencer.
Thank you for having me.
And Crystal Davenport.
Thanks for being
here.
Us.
There's an exhibit at Ames Library that I went to this weekend and checked it out, and it emerged from a course that Dr. Reddy Best taught this semester at ISU, and in which Brandon and Crystal were students, and they're here to tell us more about that so people can go and see it and hear about the presentation that's going to accompany it. Tell us first about the course. How did this course originate?
Yeah, so the course is called Black Lives Matter, Fashion, Liberation, and the Fight for Freedom. And it really started because Brandon came to me and was interested in learning about topics around Black identity and dress and the relationship between politics and history. And so at first we were going to think about a research project that might just have been a research project, but then it turned into this idea of being a whole class. Mm-hmm. And so he had, then there's this opportunity in our college as well to do a research internship for undergrads. And so I said, all right, well, let's apply for this. And then he applied, and it's pretty selective, and he got it. And so then that's when it really began last summer. And Brandon and I worked together, and he worked out some of the parts of the literature review that really contributed to some of the readings for the class, and then also to the exhibition as well. So it really started last summer when Brandon really took leadership, I would say, and I just helped him figure out some of the details, and then we, you know, had it approved by the department chair, and she was really supportive, and so then we created this new class.
And what was the name of the course?
So the course is actually the name.
Title?
Yeah, it's the name of the exhibition, and so yeah, and so we kind of decided that it made most sense to have the course and the exhibition title be the same.
Brandon, what got you interested in this, or what motivated you to bring this idea up?
Well, I feel like there's something deeper, you know, to look at. And so I wanted to really focus on the correlation of, you get what I'm saying, the identity of, you know, these individuals who are unarmed and, you know, have been shot by the police, and like focusing on the movement, and not just the movement as like what it's seen on social media, but really like the power that it has, and really like trying to understand that power.
And you're a student in the Department of Apparel, Events, and Hospitality Management, yes?
Yes.
So you saw also a connection between apparel and some other aspects of identity with the Black Lives Matter movement?
Yes, like with the t-shirts, like the I Can't Breathe or Hands Up, Don't Shoot. It was a form of, how do you say, a form of, you know, supporting the movement without, you know, being able to protest or being able to, you know, be out there with everybody else, but still saying like, you know, hey, like I'm standing up for the same thing.
In the exhibit, there is a focus on clothing, on apparel, but that's not all that the course ended up looking at. So we'll talk about the different parts of it in a minute.
All the students each developed their own topic and curated it around that idea. And so then the students really had a lot of say in the exhibition. And so I, you know, put some parameters, but they each could curate their own topic related to the idea of Black Lives Matter, fashion liberation, and the fight for freedom. And they could think about ways that, you know, outside of the movement as well. And so just thinking about the ways that identity and dress, you know, have a relationship between politics, and how can we communicate that. And I also, you know, said, think about the way we're talking to a broader audience, and we wanted to make sure that we wanted to expand beyond the campus. And mm-hmm. so we were looking at different spaces, and we then, you know, Brandon and I were, and that was also part of Brandon's internship over the summer, was to think about where can we display this, and how can we have a big impact, and how can we educate the public about the relationship between appearance and identity and politics and Black identity and resistance. And then we came up with the Ames Public Library. And so all the students definitely had a big say in everything as we were developing it.
Crystal, why did you want to take the course?
Well, my primary reason that I took it was really because Brandon created the idea for the course. But also, like, Black Lives Matter, and, you know, the fact that they incorporated fashion into the class just made it all the more interesting, because I feel like that's not something that people really thought about, was the fact that fashion is used as a form of resistance in the Black community.
So let's talk about the actual exhibit now. There are five panels, and you use the word curate. Can you explain to our listeners what curate means?
So each student's took a topic and they developed a research question. And so in the course, we learned about history or historic method and cultural studies methods. And so all in one semester, which is a lot. It's a lot to do in one semester, especially for students who have never really had a research methods or introduced to that idea. Like, what does it mean to create new knowledge? And so, you know, I taught them through the readings about, like, how do we understand new knowledge or how do we come to these ideas? And so they each then developed a research question and then curated a theme. And so they answered the research questions in different ways. So some of them used primary sources, you know, for example, news articles or different, you know, they looked at primarily looking at news or other types of sort of more recent primary sources that you might use in history. And then some of them also did, like, interviews and other types of methods for collecting information or data. And then they each wrote up about their different topics using interpreting the primary sources. And so they curated it in the sense that they wrote about the topic. And then we also had, you know, they're putting it on this one space, 36 by 48 inches. And so we were, you know, thinking about that, you know, how do you display your topic in a non-traditional format, right? Because we didn't necessarily have a space to put objects for display. We used a two-dimensional space. And so
it had to be text and images.
Text and image-based, exactly, because of the space for which we were working within. So, but we could have easily, you know, expanded into a whole traditional museum exhibition.
I see that down the road.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about the individual contributions of each student. Brandon, can you tell us about your panel?
So my panel is titled "Don't Be Alarmed, I'm Just Black and Male," Tamir, Laquan, and Alton. It speaks to three different age groups of black men and kind of their different situations in terms of being killed by the police and being unarmed. So you have Tamir Rice, Laquan McDonald, and Alton Sterling, who come from three different areas, three different, you know, situations, yet their outcome was still the same. So really digging deeper into how they were viewed by the police and what events led up to them being shot and kind of how their death formed into the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, and really, like, focusing on being black and male, how are you viewed by the police, you know, so really, like, digging deeper into that.
And what did you decide to put on your display?
On my display, I decided to go into the three different individuals, go into their stories, and really explain in depth and clearly what happened to them, how they were represented in the media, and how that representation creates the connotation of black men being feared.
Really looking at how that image and that way of positioning black men reproduces the violence.
Yes.
Crystal, tell us about your panel.
My contribution to the exhibition was basically, like, how natural hair is, like, kind of essential to black identity and how it's also used as a form of resistance. So my title is Natural Hair, Black Identity and Redemption. My first method of research was looking at Angela Davis and other social activists, women that were, like, involved in, like, Black Panther Party and all that different stuff, and basically used that as, like, a way to provide historical context to my research, because Angela Davis is known for her famous mugshot and, you know, her afro and her basically, like, her whole style. Like, some people, like, you know, in different news outlets and magazines were, you know, treating her as if she was a fashion icon, as if she was, like, a model, and others were, you know, criticizing her for the political stance that she had. My other method of research was I had interviewed three black women in Ames that regularly wear their natural hair. And I chose Ames because, like, Ames and Iowa State, they're both basically, like, they're both predominantly white spaces. So black women and their natural hair tend to stand out more in these spaces. In those interviews, I asked them questions that would dig deeper into, like, what their natural hair really means for them And within those, within that research, I found that there were a couple of different themes that had emerged from the responses they gave me. And one of those was self-expression. Another one was self-love. And the other one was resisting conformity. Ultimately, after, you know, conducting my research, I found it's still a very complex topic. There's still, like, a lot of different things that need to be, like, addressed within that whole aspect of the Black identity.
And so in predominantly white spaces, just wearing your hair in a particular way, a more natural way, or a way that doesn't, to use your word, conform in those predominantly white spaces, just that act of wearing your hair in a different way is a form of resistance. Is that the kind of the message?
It's not like a automatic, like, ooh, here I am resisting. Mm-hmm. It's more of just like a, like for me personally, growing up, I had a bit of an identity crisis. Getting like older into college and stuff like that, that's when I started my natural hair journey. And since then, I just felt more of myself. I feel like I'm in tune with myself more. So it's like when I'm in spaces with other people, like, that are different from me or, you know, look different than me, it's like I don't feel uncomfortable because I don't look like them, and nothing's really gonna persuade me to change my look to look like them.
And some of the other parts of the exhibit took historical perspectives, as Crystal mentioned in hers. One talked about body position and celebrities. They had images of Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the 1968 Olympics, and then kind of with that, Colin Kaepernick and LeBron James. Can one of you talk about that panel?
Yeah, that was by Dais Matthews, and she looked at the relationship between how looking at the power of how celebrities today and in the past have used their platforms to support different Black political movements. So she had some of the early examples, and then, you know, looking today at individuals such as Colin Kaepernick, and, you know, how sometimes, and again, she, you know, found that it was sometimes folks used their body position, right? So taking a knee, putting a fist in the air, versus other folks who used pretty overt fashion representation, you know, through t-shirt slogans. And then also folks who use, and, you know, looking at Beyonce, for example, at the Super Bowl, you know, really overtly reference the Black Panther Party representation. And so we looked at all those kinds of examples throughout our readings in the class as well. And so looking at the relationship that fashion or appearance has a really powerful message, and, you know, and the ways that it can be used. And she really looked at how celebrities use their platform today and over time.
And another one looked at merchandising, selling Black Lives Matter T-shirts and so on. What was that one about?
Well, that was by Katrine
Cadman, yeah.
Katrine Cadman, and it focused on kind of like the whole T-shirts and the merchandise of the Black Lives Matter movement, and really focusing on where your money is going. Mm-hmm. Like, are you supporting the movement, or are you just buying into this kind of like just
commercialization?
Trend, really, because, yeah, you know, like just fake support. And so really, like, mm-hmm, you know, where's your money going? Because that is important to know. You know, like, that is something really important to know. And sometimes it's kind of easier to, like, not really think about it and just, like, you know, like, you know, I have a good heart in what I'm doing, but you need to know.
And it showed an example of a company that sells Black Lives Matter T-shirts, where it's just a private company making money, and then another one where that money goes to activist work. And I think we've mentioned now four of the people who had panels. We should maybe mention the fifth one.
Yeah, absolutely. So Daryl Civils. We wanted an introduction and sort of just a brief history of the movement, because we were, you know, we're in the Ames Public Library, and we wanted to be sure to tell our audience, give them an introduction. And so we had decided, as we were discussing who was going to do each topic or what topic they were going to do, Daryl had volunteered to give us an introduction to sort of the history of the movement and how it has evolved over time. And so that's what Daryl had provided for us. And so his is second in the series, because we had also, with Brandon's idea, we or the class really as well, we wanted to make sure that we honored the folks who were unarmed and who were killed. So we have a sort of a shrine poster that's first, and it just lists many
all
of the names
yeah.
right, of folks.
Right, not all, many.
Right, just, and mm-hmm. right. And so we try to make that really clear that it's just some of the people, mm-hmm. and it's very small font, and it fills the whole poster. And so while we're looking at these intersections between fashion and appearance and the movement, it's really why we're there, is to talk about and to think through why these folks who are unarmed and who are Black are killed by police brutality.
That brings me to my next question, which is, why did you think it was important not just to have the course and do this learning and thinking yourselves, but to bring something to the public? What do you hope people take away from this exhibit?
I hope people take away truly understanding the movement, because I feel like from my experience here at Iowa State, a lot of people don't fully understand the movement who aren't Black, you know, and I know that's kind of just like plain and simple, but I really want people to understand the movement, understand it's more than just protesting, because it seems as though people get comfortable and get used to like, oh, you know, it's steady happening. Oh, it's like, you know, it's on social media all the time. So I feel like really presenting this from like many different standpoints and many different, like, you know, areas of it, from the way, like, you know, positioning and with celebrities, and then like looking at the merchandising and looking at natural hair, and then really breaking down individual aspects of those who have been killed. It really like breaks down, like, this is why it's important, and really like educating the public. So, like, that's the main goal that we want people to take away from this. Like, yes, it's a nice exhibit in the Ames Foley Library, but it is there to fully educate and to fully show you and make you aware of why this is important and why it is needed and why we need to, like, really come together and, like, really stop some of these things.
And the exhibit is there now, and then there's a presentation tomorrow night. Can you tell us about that?
Sure.
They're looking to their professor.
Yeah, so we have an opening for the exhibition, and it runs from 6 to 8. And from 6 to 7, we have the students will be standing by each of their individual contributions. And so they'll be there to interact and answer questions and educate and talk to folks about what they did. And then from 7 to 8, they'll each do a 5-minute presentation, and they'll talk about some of the work that they've done. And then we will have some time for questions at the end.
So that's Tuesday, December 4th, and it starts at 6?
Mm-hmm, at 6 p.m., and it's just in the lobby.
In the lobby.
So the exhibition is right when you walk in, and mm-hmm. then the presentation will be in the large auditorium that's in the library.
All right, so people can stop by any time to look at the panels, but if they want to hear firsthand from the students who helped develop the course and then develop the exhibit, they can come tomorrow night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for letting us know about it, and hopefully people will go and check it out, and you'll make a step toward your goal of educating people about Black Lives Matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long, I would teach my feet to fly. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby cry. tried hard to help me, you know. He put me at ease, and he loved me so. Not he made me weak in the knees. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I'm so hard to handle. I'm selfish and I'm sad. Now I've gone and lost the best baby that I ever had. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to get away on. I made my baby say goodbye. It's coming on Christmas. They're cutting down trees. They're putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. I wish I had a river I could skate away on.
That was Joni Mitchell singing her song called River. Of course, Joni Mitchell was from Canada, where skating away on a river is a real thing. People in the capital sometimes skate to work. How about that? This is Local Talk on KHOI, and we are in the midst of our fall membership drive. We're about halfway to our goal of $40,000, so if you have not donated yet, what are you waiting for? Do it right now. The easiest way is on our website, khoifm.org. And now we have some new folks here with us. We have Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, a member of Ames City Council. She's here for her monthly spot. And with her is David Martin, also a council member here in Ames. Thanks for coming in. Let's start by talking about the discussions that have been happening lately on broadband access here in Ames. So can one of you give us an update on where that is right now?
Sure. So, yeah, council took up this topic at our meeting on the 27th, and we looked at several options for how a government can provide or make broadband service better. So basically, we looked at four different models of municipal involvement, ranging from a retail model where the city actually installs, provides the infrastructure and the service itself. This would be similar to the model that you see in Cedar Falls, for example, is the best example of this nearby. Ranging from that type of model to one where maybe the city is just providing incentives for a third party to come in and be another service provider in the area, or reducing hookup fees or other maybe obstacles to broadband installation. So we talked about all those options. And the main thing we ended up doing at that meeting was asking staff to come back with a price tag of a feasibility study for the retail model. So they'll come back and they'll tell us how much it'll cost to study that model of service, and then we'll decide if we want to proceed with that feasibility study.
And David, you were, I think, the person who put this on the agenda. Is that correct?
It's certainly something that I've been pursuing for many months. It's a topic that I think is resonant in the Ames community, and it's something that we have a real opportunity to improve, to make the internet service in Ames something that we can really be proud of, and that's something we can guarantee to people, that they'll have excellent access no matter where they are in Ames, and the sort of service that they actually want. We should be able to provide a large spectrum of services.
Because people in Ames, at least from what I've heard, are very dissatisfied with the internet providers and the internet service that they currently have. Is that what you hear from people and businesses as well?
Yeah, I would say definitely. There was a survey that was taken in the community, the resident satisfaction survey, and that showed...
That was on a number of different issues or just on...
Yeah, that survey happens on a number of different issues. Yeah, but the question that related to internet service definitely showed dissatisfaction there, yeah.
And there was another survey, too, that was requested. It wasn't a scientific survey like the Ames Residential Satisfaction Survey is. This was more of a self-selecting survey that was launched last year in response to a workshop on internet topics. And interestingly, that sample attracted over 700 people from Ames who had something to say. Now, I think that most people who were completely satisfied might not have filled out the survey. We have to recognize that. But of the 700 people who did respond, over 60% of them said that they felt their service was either fair or poor. And again, over half of them were dissatisfied with the customer service overall.
And what was the workshop that you mentioned?
This took place in March of 2017, and that was, I think, an attempt just to begin to learn more about the issues that were facing Ames residents in trying to deal with the internet services.
And that was something that the city held?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, and we had representatives from the service providers at that workshop at the time.
And you mentioned one other location that has municipal provision of internet. Are there other examples in Iowa that are useful to learn from?
Yep. We've been looking at a number of them just as examples of what other areas are doing. For example, we have Davenport and Bettendorf both recently entered into an agreement with a third-party company out of Illinois called Metronet. And they that's more of an agreement where Metronet will lay the fiber and provide the service, but the town's contracted with them in a way through a bidding process. Mm-hmm. So that would be an example of a different model than the retail model that another community or two in Iowa have done. Others are proceeding, though. Pella, they just had a referendum in May of 2018, a public referendum that passed by 92% to pursue some sort of municipal broadband there. So if we didn't want to go with that retail model, like I mentioned, it does require a public referendum, actually, eventually.
I'd also like to point out that Iowa is actually a leader in this space. Iowa, as far as I know, has more municipalities who have launched some form of broadband utility than other states in the union. We have 23, 25, something like that, different cities and towns in Iowa who have done something like this.
And I've noticed that in some towns and even in some big cities, there's Wi-Fi available, you know, in downtown areas and shopping malls and places like that, shopping areas. Is that related to this but different? How does that fit in?
Well, I would say it's related but different. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, you definitely you have folks who need access, you know, maybe who either can't get it in their homes due to lack of service available or the price tag is too high. So having Wi-Fi available in public places.
For example, at the library.
Yeah. Would be one way that you can help those folks who can't get internet in their home either through lack of service or price tag. But it's not quite the same as having it in your home. People still have to make a journey to wherever the public Wi-Fi is available.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we already have that to a certain extent in Ames because all of the City of Ames facilities do offer free public Wi-Fi. But, of course, then you're limited to City Hall or I think the airport has it and other sort of city facilities. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't cover all of downtown,
right,
for example.
And so those have to be during their open hours. And
actually, I don't even know whether they have to be open for you to use it. But
so you can sit.
It has to be good weather.
You can sit outside the library and access their internet maybe even when they're closed.
Possibly.
But this is going to be a long-term process. But people can continue to have input into it?
Absolutely. This will take a while because we've just asked for more information about what it would take financially to launch a study that would give us the numbers we need to decide whether it's practical to build a much bigger infrastructure in Ames. Well, it's going to take us time until we even know how much that initial mm-hmm. study will cost. Then if we move forward on that, the study will take its own time. Mm-hmm. And so there are going to be multiple opportunities for public input to weigh in on the process.
And this will be, if something like this comes to pass, it will help businesses and individuals. So it would be available to businesses and homes.
My hope certainly is that it would be available to both of them. I don't see any reason that it shouldn't be.
Anything else on this that you would like people to know?
Just follow along and give input, as David mm-hmm. said, at the opportunities that come up.
So the discussion has started. It sounds like it started a while ago, but maybe it's heating up right now.
Yes, it's getting more specific now.
So the other thing that's kind of a hot topic in Ames right now seems to be parking in the downtown area. People have expressed displeasure with the increased parking meter rates and fines, saying it was too much all at once. And I know, Bronwyn, when you've been on before, you explained why the parking increases occurred and the need to increase that funding stream. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the reason the rates went up is because we're looking ahead to capital costs in our parking system. So, well, and operating costs too. So not the cost of replacing parking lots and meters, and also, you know, the staff it takes to go out and enforce and things like that. And when we look at those future costs, we saw that we didn't have enough capital needed, you know, to repair parking lots and things like that. So the increase in rates is meant to boost costs to go into that fund, basically, to keep the infrastructure repaired and maintained and things like that. So that's kind of why. And it hadn't been done in a long time. And I think that is unfortunate, probably, that it wasn't done more gradually over the course of several years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it had been done that way, it wouldn't have been so shocking.
Such a shock. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people have also been saying, this is just the word on the street, that ticketing has increased, that they're obviously the fines are higher, but that there seems to be an increase in ticketing.
I'd have to see data on that to verify or not. We get anecdotal stories, but yeah. I don't know if people are just tuned into it more too right now because mm-hmm. of the overall dissatisfaction with the parking situation?
I've heard that too, that ticketing is being done sort of more consistently now, and that doesn't always help people who get the tickets. But I don't think the ticket rates have gone up.
I'm sure they haven't gone up.
Okay. It's still
sorry.
$5 for an overtime violation if you pay it promptly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Certain, like the game day area parking fines, we're looking at those specifically, but that's different than downtown, just overtime parking in a downtown business area.
Yeah.
But those fines we're looking at differently because you need to incentivize people not to park on the streets for game days. But that's a different ticketing system.
And that hasn't even been enacted yet. I think we're waiting for another year before that kicks into place.
Yeah, okay. We're doing warnings in the meantime.
it also seems that fewer people are using the meters, so people are using the free spaces, you know, behind the shops on Main Street. But sometimes those are full, so the word is that people are just going elsewhere. Have you heard from businesses on Main Street that they see it affecting the number of people coming through their doors?
Yes, the businesses have been speaking to us about this, and that's certainly how they see it. But it's a complicated dynamic system, right? Because you have these free parking lots that are right next to these meters, and so when the rates changed, it was kind of anyone's guess what that would do to people's individual decision mm-hmm. process. So it's no surprise that some people decided to take advantage of the free spaces, even though they're only a block away.
Yeah.
But we don't really know the extent to which it's driving people out of the area or just driving people to different places within the area.
So is there any talk of reducing the parking meter rates or changing it? Or to study the impacts of it, or are things just going to go as is and let them play out?
Well, we did actually make a few motions at the most recent meeting when we talked about parking, and one of them was to ask staff what the cost would be if we were to reduce those dollar an hour meters back down to 50 cents an hour as sort of a mid-step for a while. And staff need to get us that number yet.
So there is some looking into this going on.
Yeah. Yep. It's not the end of it that we've seen.
Okay.
So.
And We're almost through the end of the second quarter of this year, so we've had one quarter of revenue since the change in the parking meter rates, and we're almost through the end of the second quarter. And so I think at that point, I hope that we'll be able to look and see okay. what the real financial impact is.
Okay. So more to come on that. Just quickly, also related to parking, there was news on Friday that the parking ticket data system was breached or hacked, as people say. Can you give us an update on that?
I don't know much more than that.
Than what's been in the paper.
Yeah, than what was in the news release, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate, but that's really sort of an operational city matter, and as city councilors, we tend to focus more on the policy behind things. The policy, of course, is that we don't want that to happen, but when it comes to actually the nuts and bolts that allow it to happen or that need to be tightened up afterwards, that's left to other people.
So people will have to look elsewhere for that, and there's been coverage in the newspaper, and perhaps there's something on the city website that people could check out.
Yeah, they put those press releases on the website.
Okay,
for sure.
Anything else? Any other updates you want to give us quickly on council matters?
Well, we meet tomorrow, a special meeting and public input on our 5-year CDBG plan, basically. Mm-hmm. So if folks are interested in the topic of affordable housing and housing in Ames, then they are welcome to come to that. And it sounds like it'll be little breakout sessions with people. So we take public input. It's meant to be council and public input at the same time. So.
Okay, so that's good for people to know.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you both for being here. Bronwyn Beattie Hansen and David Martin, members of Ames City Council.
Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Having us.
Yeah. Local Talk brings you these monthly visits by Bronwyn, along with monthly updates from many other organizations. If you value all that we bring to you, remember it's our fall membership drive now. We are in full swing, raising money. We're seeking 50 new members to the KHOI family. Donate online, go to our website, khoifm.org, or call 515-292-2878. And we wanted to remind people that students at ISU have organized a toy drive for children in Marshalltown who were impacted by the tornado last summer. You can drop toys at the Black Cultural Center at 517 Welsh Avenue in Ames. You can drop them off, toys or books, for children under 13 on Wednesday, December 5th, and they will be distributed through St. Mary's Church in Marshalltown. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard My Favorite Things by John Coltrane and River by Joni Mitchell. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Nutcracker, Saturday, December 8th at 1:30 and 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, December 9th at 1:30 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. We encourage you to shop local this holiday season. You can support AIM's growth while enjoying a wide array of local shopping and dining experiences that AIM's independent businesses have to offer. From the AIM's Chamber of Commerce, happy holidays. Let's shop local and grow AIM's.